Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? Infinite Tennis is the cross-country runner jogging by the court, seeing people playing, and says to himself, that looks fun. I can do that. Infinite Tennis is the guy who takes up the game and in a very short while is playing college tennis. Infinite Tennis is the life coaching that comes with the sport. A couple of items of note here. If you want to ask questions for a future show, go ahead and tweet me at School of Tennis, hashtag Tennis Troops. I'm available in the 510 and the 925 for lessons and clinics, so feel free to shoot me an email at schooloftennis@gmail.com. By the way, if you are a willing and loyal subject of the show, then you are now a tennis trooper because it's your daily fight on the front lines of tennis that make the biggest difference in the future of this sport. We have an interesting show today with Play Better Today and our guest, Ken DeHart. Ken is the first ever master professional of both the USPTA and the PGR. Now it's time for Play Better Today. Our guest, Ken, has given some great talks on many subjects all over the world, and one that I like a lot is defeating the monsters of your mind. It's a sports psychology thing, and it's helped me a lot in my game, and it's helped me to coach my players to overcome these things. So he's identified some things that cause breaks in our performance. There are two monsters of the mind that I want to highlight right now. The first is the intervening thought. Everything's going great. You're in a rhythm. You're in the zone. Then pop, a thought comes into your head like, wow, I'm off to a great start. This is a long rally. I can't believe I hit 12 backhands in a row. Ace. What happens next? You miss or you double fault. Your mind was distracted away from the task at hand. Sometimes you get overly excited about one shot, and it briefly changes your brain chemistry, rendering you momentarily uncoordinated. So practice quieting your mind and catching those times when you have an internal dialogue. Practice focusing on the shot and the sights and feelings of what you're doing. Two things can help steady you during a match: deep breathing and right thinking. In the wrong thinking category is the self-defeating thought like, don't double fault. Here's a situation: you step up for a second serve on a break point and you're about to serve a second serve, and pop, that thing comes into your mind, don't double fault. Then two things happen. One, the chance that you will double fault just went up by three times. Number two, if you don't double fault, you are probably six times more likely to hit an ineffective second serve. The statistics were made up for entertainment purposes only. All right, what to do? Do not serve with that thought in your mind. Instead, step back, take a deep breath, exhale, and say to yourself, I want to serve to the deep backhand corner. That's very empowering. Will you never again double fault? No. But you will play with more courage and you'll become more effective on the second serve point. all this sounds easy, but it takes some reflection sometimes. Sometimes you have to look back on a match and realize what was going on through your mind. All right, so get a pro, take a lesson, practice the shot, practice it in a competitive situation, play a practice match, go through all these steps to build in and really prepare so that you can defeat these monsters of your mind. First, you have to know what they are. All right, so we're going to learn about some alternative energy solutions, and then when we come back, we're going to welcome our guest, Ken Dart.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Hello, Ken. Are you there?
I'm here, Bill.
How are you?
How you doing? I'm doing great.
Excellent. Welcome to the show. Please say hi to the tennis troops.
Hey, tennis troops. This is Ken DeHart. We're here. Good Saturday morning.
All right. Excellent. Hey, so what's coming up next for you right on the horizon here?
Probably the next thing we got coming up, we're doing Wimbledon at AVAC, and we do a wooden racket tournament with everybody wears white clothes, white tennis balls, and I bring out some of my over 2,000 wood rackets for the members to use, and we have a strawberry whipped cream and beer, the American version of Wimbledon.
Wow, that's great. Do they still make white tennis balls?
They do, yeah. You have to kind of check around and get them. But Wilson still makes them, and if I have a supply of about 4 cases, I keep just put away for special cases like this.
That's surprising. So, what, besides that, do you have any projects or events that are coming up that people ought to know about?
We're doing a lot with a product called the iCoach, which is a all the research comes out of the Wilmer Eye Institute out of Boston about how to train the eye and how it connects with the brain and how it relates to your ability to see the ball, like a Federer. You know, like question, typically tennis pros, we teach how to hit a ball and where to hit the ball. What the eye coach works on is when do I swing and when do I look up. So that's been a lot of fun. We just finished my staff training here at AVAC with Lenny Schloss from Baltimore on that yesterday. And then from there, I go to my next trip's actually to Montana to speak at the high school coaches workshop for about 4 days in Great Falls, Montana. And then I come home and go to Pittsburgh to speak at a high school coaches training session and doing a USPTA PTR coaches day. That's
great.
On the horizon right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, back to the eye coach thing, I think it's really interesting that. You know, I had Oscar Wagner on the show last week, and the first thing he says with ground strokes is, find the ball. And
yes.
That sounds so simple, but when people really are cued to finding the ball, it's really amazing to me how they can move better and track the ball into their strings much, much more nicely. If they're,
I agree. One of the problems you – I'm sorry, Bill, go ahead.
No, I'm done. Go ahead.
So one of the challenges we have as tennis coaches, we try to give them technical information. And if I'm looking or I'm tracking the ball, if I give somebody technical information, I actually disconnect them from the ball. So as tennis pros, we think we make our money by talking, but the student needs to have quiet time to process what we've said and then apply it.
Yes, absolutely. That's great. That was very concise, too, because you didn't want to talk too much, I could tell. So
that's right.
Because that would be against what you just said. So you've had a recent job change. Where are you now?
I'm at Almaden Valley Athletic Club, AVAC. It's on Camden Avenue, and I have just completed my first year here after 10 years at the San Jose Swim and Record Club.
Yeah, that's great. Well, congratulations on that. And let's talk about your formative experiences. Part of the theme of the show is talking about what came before and standing on the shoulders of giants and all that. Who were some of your influences who helped get you where you are?
I'm kind of a strange history and background in tennis. I was a basketball player and cross-country runner in college, and then my freshman year I ran by the tennis courts one day and went to Kmart and bought a racket and started playing. And my sophomore year I went out for a college team. I didn't know you had to be good to play on the team. I just wanted to go play. There was a lady coach there named Helen Osborne, and she was a little rotund, really lady, and I said, I'd like to play for the team. She said, well, you can pick up balls and you can hit with the players when we need somebody. So I did. And I got a help chance to coach with the girls' team. I traveled with the boys' team and started teaching PE tennis at the college and became secretary for the tennis department. And that was my start of my tennis career. But Helen gave me a chance, and I'm sure everybody else said, are you kidding? You can't even play. Get out of here. And then I had an athletic director at the same college that helped me. He said, would you like to get your master's degree in education? I said, sure. And I said, if I could get you a scholarship, would you be interested in doing that? I said, sure. So I went to Western Kentucky University, and then I taught sports, tennis, archery, bowling, while I got my master's degree. But he was the guys that gave me the chance to kind of do things. And I suppose my key influence was a guy named Fay Bucci. And Fay lived in Nashville, Tennessee. And he was the director of tennis at Bellmead Country Club. In fact, he just retired after 39 years there.
Wow.
I was at a tournament in Murray, Kentucky, and I had just gotten beat by then 11-year-old and 13-year-old Mel and Del Purcell. And I was, got my butt kicked by these two guys who are high school kids, barely, and I'm out of college now. But I was sitting there watching a tennis match. I watched Fay Bucci play the match.
Okay, right. They turned out, didn't one of them become a top 50 in the world pro?
Oh, yeah, Mel Purcell. In fact, he plays on the senior tour some now, but he was one of the top players in the world.
Yeah.
He and his brother won the Kentucky State High School Championship in like 4 years in a row in doubles, stuff like that.
Wow, that's great. Hey, it's funny. My story is somewhat similar to yours in that maybe I was barely a 4.0 player when I tried out for my college team. Didn't make it, and then asked the coach if I could help out with the team, and my coaching career started by helping out a national champion Division II college coach, Mike Edlis, at Cal State, which is now Cal State East Bay. So, and then Chris Milligan, PTR guy, gave me a little part-time job in the summer. So those two believed in me, and, then later, and now here I am talking to you guys, So it's kind of funny how all that changes. All right, so Ken, well, I'm going to run another ad really quick here, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about the surprising facts of Ken DeHart and being a master pro and some things about playing the game better. So catch you on the other side.
I look forward to it, Bill.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, so we're back. And Ken, What's a little known fact about Ken DeHart that very few people know?
I write poetry.
Oh,
I wrote, poem for my wife for our wedding, and just finished writing one. My son has had his 13th birthday yesterday, and about 1:30 in the morning, I got up and wrote a poem about what it's like, what it means to be 13, and how it affects him and me. That you do these things, and here's how it affects me, and here's what I like about that.
Wow, that's great. I have to say I'm very pleased that you shared that. I very rarely do that myself, and I wouldn't want to admit it or share it with anyone. Okay, so moving on. Was there a time when you made up your mind that you were going to become a master pro of both organizations, the USPTA and the PTR?
No, most of those decisions are kind of made for you. I'm a bit of a collector of tennis memorabilia and things like that again. So I'd always collected information about places I'd gone or things I'd done. And then the Master Pro category became available through the USPTA. And I started looking back and I said, I'm pretty much a rookie in all this. I'm not sure. You have to have taught for at least for 10 years and have to have taught, either had ranked players or been a ranked player yourself and done research and spoken. And I started looking through my stuff and I put my application together and got it. And then the PTR offered their cert, Master Pro certification. I'd been involved in tennis for quite a long time, and I was one of the eight original Master Pros for the PTR, and the first one in the world to be a Master Pro in both. But I can't say it was something I set out to do. It's like one of those things when you have to apply for Pro of the Year or something like that. You sit down and you look at what you did in the last year and say, holy cow, I did all that stuff. But you only start out to do it. It just kind of happens. Like, I'm sure with your yeah. case, Bill, you don't plan to do all the things you do. You, but at the end of the year, you look back and you say, gosh, I can't believe I got all that done.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, okay, what are some fundamental principles of playing tennis that people miss? Because people kind of, I think, are intuitively wrong at times. They have an idea of how they want to play, but they're missing out.
One of the key things, Bill, is to, if you take the racket out of your hand and say, how would I get to the ball? Or how would I throw this ball over the net? That's what you call a natural skill. The fact that you're using a racket to throw the ball with just shows you how to do it correctly. So if you apply what you would do without a racket and then use the racket to make the same thing happen, it works pretty good. And I think one of the key things is the words we choose to describe things. If I told you to hit my hand, you'd smack pretty hard. If I said touch my hand, you wouldn't swing. So if I tell someone to hit a volley, they're going to swing. And then as a coach, I've got to figure out how to get them not to swing. But how to tell them to touch the volley or direct the volley, wouldn't have swung in the first place.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think it runs more deeply than that, because the connotations of words have an effect on our actions, because I think the word hit is a tense and a willful word. So I use the word toss because tossing is passive and relaxing. So and I have to say I've been influenced by your thinking on that and quite a bit. So absolutely, it's so important for us to understand the words that we use and the way we perceive the game with our thinking.
So, I had a hard time as a. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
No, I you were on something. Had stopped. Go ahead.
I was just saying one of the challenges I ran into as a basketball player, my coach used to tell me things like, I had to try harder, I had to want it, I had to go for it, I had to be patient, I had to. And I really didn't understand what they were saying, but occasionally I'd get it right and they would stop yelling at me, so I figure I must have understood it. So my process in teaching has been, how do you communicate something? Like if I tell someone, move your feet, but then if I could ask a question like, how much? Or I said, don't hold your racket so tight. As what? Keep your eye on the ball. How long? So what I try to do is when I ask someone to do something, I say, is it something that they could measure? But if I told someone to take two more steps between shots. If I said if your grip tension was like a level 5, which is extremely tight, versus level 1, where would you feel most comfortable? When you say, you know, keep your eye on the ball, how long do you finish your swing? So much of what we get as coaches, and you feel like, gosh, my student just doesn't get it. The problem usually is that I didn't get it because I was asking something that was very ambivalent or didn't even relate to something he knew. So you actually get a lot of what you ask for, and then you think someone else is stupid because they didn't understand it.
Yeah, there's a phrase in education, and I think it doesn't come from the United States, but it's that the teacher hasn't taught until the student has learned. So obviously,
exactly.
So the responsibility is on the teacher. Okay, so now let's talk to players at a really high level. What are some of the fine points of, you know, going from being an advanced player to really being an elite level player?
So, we had Eric Johnson plays for USC. He was one of my juniors. I started when he was 4 years old. And he's leaving to go to Holland to play some satellites this week, and then he goes to Russia for the university games. And he spoke to my juniors yesterday. And we were talking about that, and he said, well, first of all, you have to really understand you got to practice with intensity, with a purpose. And you're going to have bad days. You got to get yourself through it. But pretty much when you play, you need a target, first of all, because any kind of throwing or shooting sport requires having a target, where you want the ball to go. Then you decide what speed and what spin you want the ball to go there with. And you have to realize what we call your DNA. When I'm playing, this is for advanced players, but it works for beginners too. Are you playing defense? Are you neutralizing? Or are you attacking? And in a real match, you're defending about 10% of the time. You're neutralizing about 70% of the time, and you're attacking about 20% of the time. And that's what a pusher does. He neutralizes the whole time and says, go ahead. And so someone tries to attack 40% of the time, and then they lose because someone said, all I'm going to do is neutralize, and I'll let you attack whenever you want to.
Yeah.
You have to understand what your DNA is made up of.
That's an interesting thought, because I do agree with you that people play according to their personality, and they best suit it. Because you have some people who are accountants, and they are baseliners that are going to never miss because they the balance sheet has to always tie at the end. And then you have people who are abstract painters, and they're going to be at the net because that's where all the crazy stuff happens. And the jazz musicians will also be at the net because you can improvise there. So that's interesting. You know, the other thing that I was thinking when you were saying that was that whenever you read about someone who got a chance to play with a pro player, they almost always report that the pro didn't impress them with their power so much as their ability to control their shots and place them just about anywhere they want. So
exactly.
Underline your point. Anyway, so we have about 6 minutes left here in the live portion of the show, and then so let's try to get through two more questions. What advice would you give to parents and players as they navigate the competitive zone of junior tennis?
Parents need to understand what their job description is, and most of the time it's your job to get them to where they need to go and supply them with the things they need and provide support and love regardless of the one loss record. The kid's responsibility is to recognize that you're being provided this opportunity and you're being requested to give your best effort at all times. It may not be your best performance, but your best effort. And to stop every so often and say, you know, Dad, I really appreciate the fact that you got me to this tournament, or I appreciate the fact that you allow me to take lessons and learn more about the game. So I think it's understanding what your job description is, and then as a pro, what your job description is to relate to the parents what's going on in the lesson, so that they'll refer to not coaching the kids themselves as a parent, but remember what the pro said. Ken said do this, Bill said do that. So it's not where the parent's trying to coach the kid, because the kid will rebel against that at some point.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I really like that a lot, because teaching the kids about having that gratitude towards their parents is so key. And training parents to, I mean, I like parents when they tell me what they're seeing at a match that I'm not at.
But then,
you know, I'm also careful to say, here, let me train you in the language I use so that we are consistent with that.
That's correct. That's really good, Bill.
So next question. I never would tell someone, don't play like Roger. On the other hand, I would never say that to someone. I have a young man that I coach, and he really loves Federer. He uses the same racket. He has swings that look a lot like him. And so it's obvious a lot of time has gone into mimicking Roger's game. What are the positives about mimicking a great pro, and what are the dangers in that?
Each of us are kind of quirky in our own way with this Bjorn Borg and how he hit the ball that's totally different at the time. A lot of times when we watch the pros, we don't see what really happens because our eye can't track that fast. We end up seeing the beginning and the end of the swing and not what happened in the middle. We also don't have the athleticism or the experiences that they've had to play the way they play. I definitely could not play like Nadal. I'm not that fast, not that quick, and I'm not that intense.
Well, you need the 20 pythons. You gotta work on those pythons, Ken, on your biceps.
This is not going to happen. I've had these things for a few years, and they've never seemed to grow much at all. he's the smoother. He said, look, if you play relaxed, like you watch his face when he hits the ball, there's never any tension. If you play relaxed, you're less likely to get injured. You're going to be more efficient with your movement, and you're going to be able to enjoy the game a little bit longer and probably reach your potential a bit better than if you're playing just off sheer intensity and will.
Yeah. Essentially copy what you can copy, but realize that you may not be able to pull all of it off. What do you think of finding someone who's like a similar stature to yourself and emulating them?
That was good. You know, my son just turned 13. He's small, and he plays unusually. He plays two hands on both sides, and he switches dominant hands. Doesn't really have. He's one of the people who says, you know, I don't need to hit like somebody else. I need to play like I want to play. But
yeah.
Every player said, I need to see something in my head so I'll know what to do. So depending on my learning style or thinking style, I need to have something I can see so I can imitate it. But obviously in his head, he already sees what he wants. And he says, this is how I'm going to do it. So it depends on the picture you already have in your head. And whether you're playing like a Ferrer or, if you're 6'10", you'll play like Isner. But, yeah, I think body style has a lot to do with how you're able to play and how you're able to capitalize on certain skills.
That's interesting. So with Cameron, does he have a plan to go one-handed on his forehand at some point?
He says, I go one-handed when I need to. But the fact that I get two-handed, people get confused. And I can rip shots that are real close to me or balls that are high. But I can play one-handed when I need to. It looks like I play one-handed and two-handed on the backhand side, and it just gives you more weapons of mass confusion.
That's great because, you know, I bet you that Jan Michael Gamble would have loved to have been able to hit, you know, a one-handed forehand when he needed to.
I think so, too. All
right. So we're wrapping up the live portion of the show here, and so I'm going to say goodbye to the live listeners. When we come back from this, we're going to talk a little bit about the 10 and under mandate and Dennis Vandermeer and maybe a little bit more about Cameron and all that stuff. So how can people contact you, Ken?
Three ways. My cell phone is 408-892-3806, and it's always with me, and I return all my calls in the same hour, same day. My email is kendehearttennis@aol.com, and my website is www.kendehearttennis.com. So all right. You're going to respond to that day.
Okay, we're done with the live show. Thank you for that. And in a moment, the taping of the podcast will begin. And so we're there now. We're in the podcast section now. So what are your thoughts on the tenant under mandate, and how can it be made better?
I listen to a little bit of everything, from Wayne Bryan to what the USA has to say, and I agree a little bit with Wayne in that you can't mandate that someone has to do this. If I already have skills like that, why shouldn't I be allowed to do something a little different? If I'm at the age of six, I'm a concert pianist, why do I have to wait until I'm 13 to perform at concerts?
Right.
But by the same token, the 10 and under opportunities have been amazing and a huge growth for American tennis. And our own program here at AVAC, it's our biggest program. We're using red ball, orange ball, and green ball. But I don't mandate that they have to play that way.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. I mean, the interesting thing to me is that all the best pros, in my mind, have been using transition balls for a while. And the ones who are also great tennis pros who manage to teach the kids well without using them at all, they have a way figured out of bridging their learning. So,
right.
You know, forcing people to do it a different way, I think is counterproductive. And who could argue with Robert Lansdorp and his success and tell Robert, no, Robert, you have to teach with transition balls so your kids can succeed at the transition ball level. I think he probably would start cursing a blue streak.
You know? He would.
Yeah, no, I love him because he's such a teddy bear, even though he comes off so gruff, you know. But, I'm with you on that. I think more people should use the transition balls and do it more often, and there ought to be a program where the kids can play and learn all of their shot combinations. But when you get that phenom who just can rip the cover off the ball when they're six and they have uncanny hand-eye coordination, that's not going to help them so much.
Yeah. I think we do a lot. We have junior tennis matches for red ball and orange ball and green ball. And we have about 80 kids every weekend that play. And the red ball kids, the little guys sitting on 36-foot court, they serve them balls. They go to the net. The orange ball kids, they're not afraid to come to the net because the court's a little smaller and they can still get the ball. But if you watch them, they go, and their rallies are like 30 to 50 balls in some points. And so they learn point construction, which they would never learn with the yellow ball. And what we try to do with our advanced kids, we give them one orange ball and say, do a 100-ball rally. When they come back, I'll give you a green ball, do a 50-ball rally. Then we give them a yellow ball. Of course, we're hoping for 10 or 15 balls in a yellow ball.
I love that. And here's what I did. I took over a tennis team that had lost in North Coast section in the first round, and rather meekly, they were not really too intense about trying to do well at the sectional level. One day, I had them play with orange balls, and I just let them play with the orange balls for about 10 minutes, and then I was like, okay, what did you discover? And they were like, I don't know. I said, did you see how if you have a deep short combination or a short deep, how devastating that is? They were like, yeah. Well, the same thing's true with the regular ball. It's just not as pronounced. And then what happened? Within 2 years, they won the sectional title.
Oh, you know, wow.
Beating the two and the one seeds in the same day in 97-degree heat. But I'll tell you, that experience, those orange balls help them tremendously. All right, so I think we've done enough on that. So now, do you have any? What can you tell us about your time with Dennis Vandermeer? Because I think he's a fascinating character. Do you have any good stories about him?
I got a few. I remember I told briefly in the live cast, we talked about a guy who got me involved in tennis teaching was Faye Bucci from Belle Meade. And I'm living in Nashville, Tennessee, and I got my first job as director of tennis ever at a club called Sequoia. And they said, let's go down to Florida and get certified in this PTR program. I said, okay. So we're driving down to Florida. I mean, I wonder what this guy can teach me. I don't already know. I'm pretty good. And we get down there, and the PTR course back then was 10 days long, not 10 hours long like it is now.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe the things that he taught me that were so simple. The progressions and the verbiage to use and the rotations of people. So it was amazing. And that was in 1976, and I've been a member of the PTR and the PTA since 1976. But the most amazing experience ever in my tennis teaching career was those 10 days with tennis. And what I thought I knew, I was like, oh my gosh, I haven't even stepped out of the baby pool yet.
I travel around the world.
I've been in Mexico and Japan and Hong Kong and Germany with Dennis because he's traveling. We've trained other coaches to coach, and it's amazing how he could, of course, remember everybody's name. He'd remember, 50 names and what they did and what their stroke was like and their address and their idiosyncrasies on their shots. And just an amazing amount of memory that he had. And his biggest thing was probably his love for the game. We were having lunch in Mexico one day, and he says, Kenny, he called me. My grandmother and Dennis both call me Kenny. But he says, Kenny, you know what? He said, there's nothing more in life that I love than just playing tennis. He says, my day is good when I hit tennis balls every day. He made time every day to go hit tennis balls. At lunchtime, he's out hitting tennis balls.
That's great. So were there any crazy things that happened? Tell us something about a little unusual occurrence between when you and Dennis were together.
It happened back in the old days. And, Eve Kraft was head of the USTA, and she and Dennis had a love-hate, mostly hate relationship that went on. And just watching them, how they interacted with each other, and sitting there being amazed at these two people who are both leaders and both wanting to be in charge of things, and how they interacted with each other was always scary and yet still fun at the same time, just to kind of think about it. Like, I waited for a fist fight at every moment. And they both were right. They both were right. I think the most weird thing that ever happened is like trying to travel with Dennis, like you're in Japan, because there's about six of us. We're carrying books and DVDs and rackets and balls, and we've got about three or four tennis bags on our shoulders, and we're trying to catch the train. Well, in Japan, the train stops for 1 minute, and it takes off because it's on time. One guy gets in the car, and we're throwing bags in the car as fast as we can, and then we jump on the train before the door closes. And then when the train stops, and we throw bags out, and we jump out as fast as we can. So it's always a timed event to see how fast we get our gear on and off the trains in Japan to make the train, and I get caught with one guy going to Tokyo and the other guy going to Shanghai.
That's great. I have two words for you. Taxi cab.
There's no taxi cab where they are, where we're going. Because we're headed from northern Japan and the ski resort to from Kashua down into Tokyo. And there's no cabs. You got to get there by the bullet train fast. Because then it did everything quickly. And so we had to get there on time for our next presentation.
All right, very good. So so what's the latest with Cameron? How's he doing?
He's doing great. A couple things. Our team from AVAC this summer, with Coach David Crane and myself, our 1500 team went to the Nationals in Columbia, South Carolina. It was the first time the team from NorCal had gone to the Nationals co-eds in 5 years. So it was really great experience for all the kids that went, just to be at a national event and be at Master Pros. Jorge Andrew, who's the director for Lexington Tennis, so they have 50 courts. They have two clubs and have 50 courts. And to see 250 kids out there performing, and they'd ask Cameron if he would sing the national anthem. He's quite a good singer. And he said, sure. And we all thought he was going to sing with the rest of the kids. And so that morning we're washing the courts down and drying them off in the squeegee, and they said, no, you're going to sing it by yourself. And he said, what? And you're going to sing it a cappella. What? So there's 250 kids up there, and they hand Cameron, they said, now to sing the national anthem from San Jose, California, Cameron DeHart. He's got the microphone in his hand, there's a little pause, and Oh, say, can you see? And I can't sing. He can't. And so he sings the whole bloody thing. He did add two new words, but he got a standing ovation when he finished. Most of them realized that they wouldn't have done that. But he's not shy. He likes to entertain, and he talks to the adults. But that was a fun event. And then our team didn't win the event, but we got the sportsmanship award. And that was, for us, as important as any time, having won a national title.
That's terrific. Yeah, you know, my son and I, we went down to San Diego for the Little Mo tournament, and he actually tripped falling backwards and fell on his head during his match. I asked him if he wanted to continue, and he said yes, because he didn't want the other kid to not to win because he quit.
Oh, that's right.
Philip ended up getting the one sportsmanship award out of 150 kids, and that was maybe one of my most proud moments during his tennis career. So,
boy, that's amazing.
Yeah, so that's great about Cameron, that he got to sing for all those people and you know, he show off his chops and all that great stuff. So thanks so much for coming on the show. It was great talking with you, and maybe we can catch up another time on a future show. I'd love to have you on again, because I think there are a lot of – we just scratched the surface during this one.
Oh, yeah. We got a bunch more stuff to go on.
Yeah. So, anyway, have a great day. And, you know, Tennis Troops, thanks for listening. I'm going to go on with some more information here. But thanks so much for coming on, and have a terrific day on the courts today, Ken.
Bill, I look forward to it. Thanks so much. I got about another 8 hours to go today, and I'll see you on the flip side.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So, everybody, let's thank Ken for coming on. Just so you know, I am actively searching for a guest who is 100% behind the 10 and under mandate. So if that's you, contact me, please. Or if you know someone who's completely behind the thing, then let me know. You are invited. I have reached out to the national governing body and some other people, and so far people are declining to come on the show, and just like to talk to them and ask some questions. And I mean, so far I'm finding most people really enjoy the transition balls, but they also think that there should be a pathway for the phenomenal talents. Next week's guest is Dan McCain, an accomplished artist and a great coach. And his new book, Momentum on the ATP Tour, is a must read for thoughtful players, coaches, and parents. Find it on Amazon and take a look, and then that will fuel some questions. So please take a look at that. Prepare some questions. It's a striking volume with pretty pictures that appeal to me. But even with a cursory scan, you'll find that the presentation of the information really appeals to the visual and kinesthetic understanding of how to play. So much, like Ken said, that's so much more important than the verbal instruction format, all right? So after Dan, we have Vic Braden scheduled. If Vic can't make it, then I have a very special treat for you. I have another guest lined up already, but Vic mentioned he's working on a very large research project at the moment, and we've got it down in pencil. So hopefully Vic does show up on the show. I also want to remind you that the Wayne Bryan show really struck a nerve with people, so you might want to check that out. And the Oscar Wagner show was very special to me personally, so I think I really enjoyed that one the most myself. And be sure to check out all the UR Tennis Network shows, because UR Tennis does want your voice to be heard. So prepare your questions for Dan and Vic. Send me a tweet, #TennisTroops, and have a great day on the court today. Be sure to go out and defeat the monsters of your mind on the court.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.